You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the combined July-August 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Behind the Curtain by Josh Sanborn, with photographs by Peter Van Uckmel. The first night we talked was April 6th. Patrick was embalming a body when I called. He wasn't sure if the person had died of COVID-19, but he treats everybody as if it's infected. Before the pandemic, he would embalm the same way his great-uncle Leo did, in his suit, sleeves rolled up, with a pair of gloves. But he started working in full personal protective equipment once he began taking in COVID-19 cases. That evening, he told me, as he worked, he had 40 bodies in his care. He normally has two or three. The volume of calls he'd received over the last 2 weeks was unlike anything he'd ever experienced. At first, about 25 bodies a week were coming in. At that rate, or even slightly higher, Patrick thought he could manage. He turned a storage room into an overflow space with racks for caskets and cremation containers and converted one of his chapels into a room for dressing bodies. But in the first 4 days of April, he held 30 funerals and was overwhelmed. He had to start saying no. His business just wasn't built to do this many. "We tried to put the brakes on things," he says, "but families still kept calling." Many funeral homes stopped holding services, but Patrick kept them with restrictions in place. No more than 10 people, everyone in mask, social distancing required. For those not attending, he set up Zoom calls. "There's an indirect risk we have to take," he says. "So many COVID-19 patients died alone in nursing homes or in hospitals on ventilators. The families often barred from caring for them, especially in their final moments." Patrick felt he had to give them one last chance to say goodbye. "You can't shut your door," he says. Patrick had also learned from the New York City Medical Examiner's office that bodies would be sent to a potter's field on Hart Island if they weren't claimed after 6 days. It bothered him that families might have their loved one buried in a mass grave because he didn't have anywhere to store them, so he bought a $15,000 shipping container, which could hold 36 at a time, doubling his capacity. When Patrick inquired about it, the vendor told him he had to buy it outright. No one would rent it again after knowing what Patrick was going to do with it. On Wednesday, April 8th, the funeral home held 6 funerals. The next day, they'd perform 5. Friday, 5. Saturday, 3. We talked late that evening. Patrick was going through the messages he'd received, trying to figure out which families needed the most help. He talked to family members who'd called 30 funeral homes. Sometimes the person calling didn't even realize which one they were contacting until someone picked up. "It's taken a physical and emotional toll," he says, "and the thought of doing this for another month." He didn't finish. He seemed a bit unsure about where all this was heading and whether he was making the right moves. A couple of days later, he found a crematory in Schenectady, New York, where he could start transferring multiple bodies. The refrigerated container was supposed to arrive soon. That day, he received 200 more messages from families. He was trying to get to all of them, but it was impossible. "There's just no way that we can help everyone," he says. Next photo, resting place. Francisco James covers an embalmed body waiting to be dressed for viewing. Paul Kearns Stanley has worked at the funeral home since 1990, even longer than Patrick. He majored in English literature at the University of Delaware. never considering funeral service as a career option. When he graduated, though, he had no job, so his father-in-law offered him a spot in the family business. He brings me in the first day of work. He says to me, "People think in funeral service, you wear a white shirt, sit behind a desk, tell people what to do, and fill out papers the whole day. That's not what it is at all. You have to roll up your sleeves and do the work." Doing the work meant vacuuming, loading bodies on stretchers, greeting grieving families at the door. And he liked it. He worked his way up, becoming the funeral home's number two. Like Patrick, he's understated, soft-spoken, thoughtful. But where Patrick is more gregarious, Paul is reserved. Staffers say he has the office's poker face. He's a full head taller than Patrick, and partial to bow ties and dark pinstripe suits, even in the middle of a pandemic. In these circumstances, Paul says, there's no way to perform funerals the way they should be done. They're stunted, he says. I walk away from funerals now and say, that really sucked. That was not a good funeral. While he's been in the business 30 years, he can check off the number of firsts that he's experienced just in the last 2 months. He's buried 4 people in 1 day. He said, I can't help you right now. He's made people cry, and the first time he's ever truly been bothered by something occurred in April. When he visited Elmhurst Hospital to retrieve a body from one of the 3 trailers sitting outside the morgue's receiving area. I couldn't believe what I saw, Paul said. There was no rhyme or reason to how the bodies were placed. They were on the floors. There was a head in this direction, one in that direction, at all different angles. No shelving. It was just horrific. He asked how many people were inside. The attendant told him 67. In normal times, there are 6. Paul watched as the morgue attendant held onto the trailer sides as he stepped over bodies, looking for name tags. He was afraid he was going to fall and hurt himself. There was no place to walk. There's no one to blame. It caught everyone completely off guard. The bodies just came so fast, Paul told me. The 2 funeral home workers who saw the worst of it were Jose Soto, 30, and Francisco James, 29. They were tasked with making runs to the hospital morgues around the city. Jose is a jokester, a talker, and he'll do anything the funeral home asks him, even if he's never done it before. He dresses bodies, he loads them into cremation containers, he builds shelving, he swats flies, a funeral home menace, and tapes them onto a white sheet of paper to show his kill rate, 5 one day in mid-May. James, known as Frankie, is a newly licensed funeral director. He started on February 25th, just before the pandemic engulfed the city. As soon as the funeral home is authorized to retrieve a body, the 2 head out, Jose wearing a black heavy coat with cargo pockets, his COVID jacket, and Frankie in a black Versace jacket with a gold logo that from a distance looks like an official seal, as if he's with the state health department. Some of the morgue attendants have sat up a bit straighter seeing him from a distance. When they arrive, they pull their van into the back of the morgue, head into one of the refrigerated trailers, identify the correct body, place it on the stretcher, buckle it in, and load it into their vehicle. Next photo, last rites. Many funeral homes stopped holding services, but Kearns continued offering them to grieving families with restrictions in place. There's an indirect risk we have to take, he says. You can't shut your door. As the epidemic grew, the hospital's morgues turned nightmarish. Many hospitals began bringing in large refrigerated trucks, but didn't have shelving or a system in place at first. Before lighting was installed, Frankie and Jose often used their phones as flashlights to identify bodies in the darkened trailers. Sometimes it took them 20 minutes to locate the right one because the ID tag had ripped off and they'd have to open a body bag to make a positive identification from the person's wristband or toe tag. They didn't know if they could contract COVID-19 from the corpses, so they always wore full PPE. Out of all the morgues they visited, the one at Brookdale University Hospital was one of the most disturbing. On April 3rd, Frankie recorded a video inside one of Brookdale's trailers. A man can be seen lying outside of his body bag. Others appear piled on top of each other. It's human chaos. Right as soon as you opened the door, there was just a pile of bodies you had to climb over to get into the truck, Frankie tells me. These body bags were very cheap. When you went to move the zipper, the bag just ripped. You saw people's arms hanging out, legs hanging out. A guy was naked out of the bag. They eventually found who they were looking for. She was right in front, underneath one other, face down. Frankie saw a couple footprints on the back of the body bag. After hearing about the situation at Brookdale, Patrick Kearns spoke to the New York State Funeral Directors Association, which asked the funeral home staff to record what they were seeing. The association says it received similar calls about the city's makeshift morgues and alerted the governor's office. Nobody really thinks of us on the front lines, Frankie says. You hear about firefighters, doctors, but you never see thank you funeral directors. We're the last of the first responders. In the first 12 days of April, the Kearns funeral homes performed 100 funerals. They'd taken in around 10 bodies daily, including one from their very block, a woman who died at home, later listed as probable COVID-19. Patrick, about to go home for dinner when he got the call, instead walked over to say they'd do the removal. By this time, the sheer numbers had begun to scare him. They're coming in quicker than they're going out, he said. Even for people used to dealing with death, this is completely different. He was having trouble sleeping. He'd helped families through difficult situations before. Mothers who'd lost children, people killed in horrific accidents. But he always knew there'd be an end. He could perform the service, go home, have dinner, and feel like he helped somebody. If there was a finite amount, like you knew there was a catastrophe, but it was a finite amount, I think it would be easier, he said. But now, when you've helped somebody, there's always someone else. And for every person you've helped, there's 10 you can't. The following day, the refrigerated container arrived. Patrick parked it in an alley, a white barrier blocking it from view, its low hum a new constant presence inside the funeral home's garage. Patrick's mood soon picked up, knowing he was expanding his capacity and could stop saying no so often. He also learned that his older brother Thomas planned to head down from Vermont to help drive bodies to the crematory. But around the same time, he started getting more concerned for his staff and for his physical well-being, and questioned whether they could keep this pace up. He began wondering whether he and possibly his employees had already been infected and recovered, remembering one cold, rainy night in March when he experienced chills and severe back pain. He realized he needed to take care of himself. He was wearing down. A week later, Patrick fell inside the refrigerated unit as he was standing on one of the shelves. He stepped down, but misjudged the height, falling backward and hitting his head on the opposite shelf. He saw a flash of white light, but didn't lose consciousness. Afterward, he drove to one of his funeral homes, and then a cemetery, before he realized he might have a concussion. At the cemetery, he was worried the family would ask him to pray at the gravesite. Instead, they all stayed in their cars and watched the burial from afar. On the way to another cemetery, Patrick realized he shouldn't be driving. He couldn't form full sentences, and when he got out, he couldn't walk without stumbling. His wife drove him home. It was the first day he'd had off in weeks. Hyrcania Moncrief is an outspoken contrast to Patrick and Paul's understatedness. She has an ear-to-ear smile and springy ash-blonde hair she says has been coming out in clumps since the pandemic began. Around the office, she often wears dark pantsuits. She's blunt, no nonsense, especially when she believes others, cemeteries, hospitals, morgues, aren't pulling their weight. I have no chill, she says. Hyrcania, 36, first started working part-time for Patrick in the mid-2000s, before returning full-time last July. She's Afro-Latina and bilingual, her language skills helping the funeral home serve the neighborhood's many Spanish-speaking families. Her instinct to care for the dead came early. Hyrcania's aunt was born with a heart defect and was in and out of hospitals. The day her aunt died, Hyrcania showed up at the hospital with a removal van. It was her way of saying thank you. I was gearing myself up for that moment, to be able to offer that, she says. I didn't know I was grooming myself all my life. During the crisis, Hyrcania has been increasingly exasperated by the state of bodies coming from hospitals. Treatment for COVID-19 is highly invasive, especially for those on ventilators. A huge, rigid tube is placed inside a patient's mouth and windpipe to keep air passages open. A Velcro strap is placed tightly around the face to secure it as two protective beige pads are placed on the cheeks. Hyrcania knows all this because she sees it when she unzips the body bags. They come to us still attached, she says. The tubes are being left in the patients. Hyrcania says she doesn't think the hospitals are taking funeral homes into consideration and are needlessly passing the risk of exposure on to them. They throw them in a bag, she says. Let the funeral home deal with it. Patrick tried to push back on the hospitals, but eventually realized they'd have to remove the equipment themselves. These doctors and nurses, it's not like they're sitting on their hands doing nothing, he says. They're overwhelmed. And you know what? This person is now dead, and that's my job, to take care of the dead. When staffers remove the tubing, they wear a shield and mask and cover the deceased face with a large piece of cotton. The intubation tube may contain a high viral load and takes a lot of strength to remove. One of the scariest moments is taking this equipment out, Hyrcania says. Imagine pulling as tightly as you can. If a patient has an oxygen mask on for too long, it can create a sort of bed sore on the face and disfigure the mouth. The tan pads can distort the cheeks. It's up to the funeral home to try to restore some of the damage. Hyrcania, married with two children, says she's felt overwhelmed by the emotional strain of it all, as well as the 16-hour days that have kept her from her family. Her husband, Ian, has taken over the duties at home, caring for their infant son and 5-year-old daughter, making dinner, cleaning. Hyrcania has missed her son's first steps and first words, and she barely sees her daughter. She wakes up. She goes, "Hi, Mommy, see you tomorrow," Hyrcania says. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm forfeiting my family for strangers. But right now, we're in a pandemic. This is non-negotiable. On April 27th, the crematory in Schenectady had a minor explosion in one of its gas chambers. The funeral home was planning to perform 4 or 5 cremations there a day. As a backup, Patrick began using a crematory in Connecticut, roughly the same distance away. Getting another online quickly was critical. The funeral home serves a number of Guyanese families, many of whom are Hindu, and require that cremation take place as soon as possible after the service. The person making those crematory runs was Thomas Kearns. Like his younger brother Patrick, Thomas spent much of his time at the funeral home growing up. He He get woken up in the middle of the night and tag along with his dad to perform a home removal. He worked as an attendant during wakes. He casketed bodies. It was just the way it was, he says. When Thomas went to college, he figured he'd become a funeral director and assume the family business. After all, he was named for both his father and great-grandfather, who started the funeral home. It didn't much matter what he majored in, because he'd end up in mortuary school. So he studied art history and loved it. Before long, he got sidetracked working with artists. They were expecting me to take over, he says. Probably one of the hardest things I did was telling my father I wasn't going to do it. Even without Thomas, the Kearns funeral home is a family affair. There's Patrick, his brother-in-law Paul, and Paul's son Sam, who's an administrative assistant. But over the last couple of months, Patrick's son, a high school math and physics teacher, came in to help, as well as Paul's college-age daughter, Maeve, who started retrieving bodies from hospitals. When Thomas heard about his 19-year-old niece transporting corpses, he knew he had to help. He bought some plywood, constructed body boards, threw them into his truck, loaded his tools, and drove down from his home in Vermont. Before he left, he made sure his life insurance was paid up. For weeks, Thomas woke around 4 a.m. and drove to the funeral home, where a van holding 4 to 6 bodies was waiting for him. By 5:30 a.m., he was on the road in the pitch black, driving north on the interstate to crematories in Schenectady or Putnam, Connecticut. The solitary drive was the toughest part of his day. 6 hours on the road, with nothing to think about other than the pandemic happening all around him. He kept his GPS on, even though he'd already made the trip numerous times. He was worried he'd drive right past the exit, his mind elsewhere. Growing up being at the funeral home, if you had 7 deceased people in an embalming room, it would be flooded. You couldn't believe how busy you were, and I think during the height of the pandemic we had 70 one day, which is just unfathomable. People everywhere. Embalming room filled, morgue filled. One of the chapels is converted into where we're dressing and casketing bodies, Thomas says. The scale of it is just unimaginable. In late April, stories surfaced of dozens of decomposing bodies found in trucks at a Brooklyn funeral home. The owner, Andrew Cleckley, told reporters he'd been overwhelmed by the number of bodies and had been using the trucks for overflow storage after already filling his chapel with more than 100 bodies. There are a few others that might be in over their heads, Patrick says. Trust me, it's easy to get over your head here. While hospitals received significant attention from state and local governments throughout the crisis, funeral homes like Kearns were generally left to figure things out for themselves. I felt on my own, Patrick says. The mayor's office was completely clueless at first. The problems at the funeral home in Brooklyn pushed the city to become more responsive to how overwhelmed the entire funeral home industry had become. City officials didn't want another incident of bodies decomposing in trucks. Now they were reaching out. Do you need anything? Can we help? Weeks earlier, the medical examiner had extended the deadline to retrieve bodies from 6 days to 14. Now the city said that funeral directors could send bodies back if they got overstretched. Patrick says that's never happened before. The medical examiner also removed the deadline for sending bodies to Hart Island, placing them in long-term cold storage instead. The city's come around 180 degrees. By early May, Patrick began seeing signs of progress. The death and infection rates were trending downward. They were performing 4 or 5 funerals a day, about half as many as in early April. Around this time, Patrick learned that he had indeed contracted the virus. That rainy, cold March night, when he experienced back pain, was likely a mild symptom of COVID-19. He now has the antibodies. He thinks he probably got the virus from relatives of a COVID-19 patient rather than a body in the funeral home, but he'll never really know. The funeral home's main office is located in a squat brown brick building on a street in South Richmond Hill that's half residential, half commercial. On a mid-May morning, staffers were directing a funeral in a chapel that had been split in half, one part used for viewings, the other for staff to prepare bodies. There, Jose Soto was dressing the body of a man who had died on his 73rd birthday. He was mostly bald, with red splotches on the top of his head. On the right side of his face was a blackish bruise. His hospital wristband was still attached. He needs his makeup done, Jose said. Next to him was a larger man in his 20s with a tattoo on his right biceps that had a woman's name in script above a red heart. Nearby, an elderly woman dressed in a purple blouse and floral scarf was already in her casket. Inside was a photo of her holding yellow flowers. An older woman with gray streaks through her black hair was lying on a stretcher next to an overweight woman. Three of the five bodies here were probable COVID-19 cases, and a fourth, the man Jose was dressing, was first believed to have had COVID-19 and put on a ventilator, but later tested negative. Jose dressed him in a white T-shirt and a pair of black suit pants. In the garage, he then helped put several other bodies inside cardboard containers. Handle with care, printed in green, on the side of each one. He checked one of the bodies for a pacemaker, which can explode inside a crematory. Nothing. Jose zipped up the body bag and closed the container's cardboard lid. Several staffers helped place the box on a dolly and loaded it into a van. Patrick shut the doors. The bodies would be driven to Connecticut tomorrow. That afternoon, Erkenia told me about her friend's father, who she called Papito, and who had died of COVID-19 a few weeks earlier. Erkenia had vacationed with him. Some funeral directors might not want to arrange a funeral for someone they knew, but she did. Erkenia embalmed him and dressed him in a gray suit with a coral necktie. It was the same suit she remembers Papito wearing when he walked his daughter down the aisle. I cried a lot, Erkenia says. What got me was scooping him up, that I had him in my hands. It broke my heart that he was in a state where I could lift him. That afternoon, Erkenia finished dressing the man who died on his birthday. She placed him in a dark suit jacket and a navy tie, loosely tying it around her neck first, to get the knot right. Nearby, Jose was shaving the man with a heart tattoo. The sun began setting, splashing through the pinkish stained glass windows and white curtains. Erkenia put cover-up cream on the man she was prepping and pointed out what looked like a bed sore underneath his chin, likely an injury from the ventilator that doctors initially put him on. She lightly shaved the gray hair on the side of his head. That's much better, she said. She thought again of her friend's father whom she'd prepared. I enjoyed getting him ready. I really enjoyed it, she said, getting him all dressed up. I like getting them ready to go wherever they're going, because we are the last caregiver. For now, the place this man was going was on the other side of the divider for tomorrow's service, his face no longer showing any signs of bruising, no apparent marks from the ventilator. He was trimmed and dressed in his finest dark suit. The staff hung a gold and silver crucifix on the inside of the open section of his casket and placed a brown kneeler in front for prayers. He was ready for the morning viewing. On May 17th, in the early evening, Patrick had left work by 6:30 p.m., the earliest he'd gotten out of the office in weeks. At home, he received two more calls, two more families who needed help. But things were slowing down enough for him to start thinking about what he'd just been through. That first COVID-19 case, back on March 18th, was the 106th body the funeral home had taken in this year. By the end of May, the yearly count was 475, more than all the services they'd performed in 2019. From mid-March to the end of May, the funeral home had received 1,370 calls from families requesting services and carried out 369 funerals. There was a small window to make the right decisions, Patrick told me. I feel very good about what we've been able to accomplish. The funeral home was now in a position to perform a disinterment from the mass burials on Hart Island. The death was from March, one of the hundreds of calls lost in the sheer volume and somewhere deep in the stack of papers sitting on his filing cabinet. It was one of the calls that had haunted him. When we talked, Patrick was sitting outside near a gas fire pit trying to relax. It's weird to sit idle and not worry, he said. The night before, he went into the office by himself, even though he didn't need to, the refrigerated container kicking on and off, keeping dozens of bodies in his care preserved. For now, Patrick says he'll keep it, as well as the van he bought for removals and crematory trips. He's bracing for a resurgence in the fall. Patrick says one of the more difficult things in all this was that his father, Thomas, in his early 80s, was on the sidelines during the biggest crisis the industry had ever seen. I called Pat and said, I still have my license. I could direct funerals, Thomas says, but they knew better than I did. Patrick realized he could not allow his dad to be exposed to the virus, so Thomas stayed put. But Patrick still felt his dad's presence around the funeral home. Decades ago, Thomas had relocated their main office to their current building, one that can also hold funerals upstairs, and turned part of the driveway into a garage where they now hold caskets and moving vans. Patrick says his dad's physical restructuring of the business allowed him to better manage the crisis. He told his father, "You did help. You are helping." I spoke with Patrick more than a dozen times, beginning in early April. I often started our conversations with a simple, "So how are things going?" He'd routinely answer, "Good, good." Even though things were rarely good, especially then. During one of our last conversations in May, he said that when he was having trouble sleeping, he was also experiencing what he called heart flurries, as if his heart was threatening to burst out of his chest any time he lay down. He got a prescription for Xanax. It helped him rest and leveled him out emotionally, something he desperately needed. I no longer found myself in the corner of my office crying, he said. I asked him if he meant that, whether he'd really been crying in his office. Absolutely, he said. Every morning in the shower, periodically in my office. It wasn't the deaths that triggered it, he said. It was the opposite. It was when he thought of his brother driving down from Vermont. It was the time his college friend sent him money to buy lunch for his staff. It was the time when the funeral home didn't have enough sheets for all the bodies, and his wife mentioned it to a neighbor, and before long, half a dozen people were stopping by, bringing them linens. It was the people taking care of them.
Thank you.
From the Vanity's opening act, Flip Out, as the all-American heartbeat of cheer, Jerry Harris is the feel-good breakout we need. By Britt Hennemuth. In the photos, Jerry Harris. And Harris delivers some mat talk to his teammates in a scene from Cheer. In the Netflix docuseries that follows the cheer squad of Navarro College in Corsicana, Texas, 20-year-old Harris became a breakout star for his untiring jubilance and characteristic mat talk, shouts of encouragement to pump up teammates. Here, the beloved underdog-turned Hollywood hero shares quarantine motivation, memories from his first Oscar night, and what's next for Navarro. His passion began at a very early age. We never had the most money, and I lost my mom at 16, but cheer has become my family. It has made me the person I am today. When Netflix first arrived at Navarro, some teammates turned it on for the cameras. Girls wanted makeup, guys wanted a haircut, but not Harris. I wasn't going to just change the way I look. Absolutely not. The show catapulted Harris to stardom. He has more than 1 million Instagram followers, a roster of fans including J.J. Watt, Chrissy Teigen, Oprah, and as Ellen DeGeneres' red carpet correspondent at the Oscars, he interviewed winners Brad Pitt, Laura Dern, and Renee Zellweger. The newfound fame won't change who I am, because just as quick as it came, it can get taken away. His favorite memory from the Vanity Fair Oscar party: Hailey Bieber was obsessed with me, he says with genuine modesty. I was like, am I really talking to Hailey Bieber for 30 minutes right now? It was just so pleasing. Although his team trained for a year, the 2020 cheerleading competition in Daytona, Florida has been canceled, but the current college student remains hopeful. We were heartbroken, but I might have another year of eligibility now, and I'm looking at business opportunities at school as well. As for a second season of cheer, We would love it, but we don't know yet. We're thrilled to just ride the ride. Away from the gym, amid coronavirus, the self-proclaimed sci-fi fan is listening to Billie Eilish, binging the Scream series, and offering some timely Matt talk. This is only temporary. It's going to be over before we know it. Try to make the best of it. We got this. Fair play. Danielle Chang and William Lee, host of the food and culture series Lucky Chow, share their favorite mouth-watering shows. Midnight Diner, Tokyo Stories, Netflix. This cinematic series is the perfect combination of food porn and incredible storytelling. Each delicious 25-minute episode transports you to late-night Tokyo and the colorful characters who inhabit it. The French Chef, Amazon Prime and PBS. Whether you're learning to master a soufflé or prepare an iconic coq au vin, Julia Child makes it easy and fun. A few episodes of The French Chef are guaranteed to make you say bon appétit with confidence. Flavorful Origins, Netflix. This beautifully filmed series serves up 12-minute episodes, each exploring a gorgeous dish or ingredient from the Yunnan and Chaoshan regions of China. This is not your typical dumpling and noodle fare.
Thank you.
The beat goes on. For a living room jam or a soothing escape, musicians turn out fresh sounds to suit the season by Lisa Robinson. Soul Sisters, we want to inspire more girls to pick up guitars, write, produce, and engineer, says Danielle Heim of the L.A.-based band Heim, who released their third studio album this summer. We're songwriters, she adds, but we're also a rock band. It's where we feel most ourselves. The album, with the wry title Women in Music Part 3, features songs written by all three Heim sisters, Danielle, Est, and Alana, who adds, we're always writing, especially when we aren't touring. Danielle gets some of her best song ideas when we're on an airplane about to take off. This time we had the best time experimenting with different sounds. This is the most confident we've ever felt on a record. Both sides now. Singer-songwriter Ellie Goulding releases her new album this past summer, and she says it definitely reflects a turbulent time in the world, combined with escaping reality a bit. Goulding split the as-yet-untitled album into two sides. Side A features songs which she says acknowledge a dark world where no matter how enlightened you are, relationships still dictate our happiness, and heartbreak can still be the most painful thing. It's been 10 years since Goulding's debut album, Lights, which led to a career of Grammy nominations, 17 million album sales, and 20 billion streams. Goulding, who married art dealer Casper Jopling in 2019, adds, the songs also symbolize growing up, becoming a woman, and reminiscing about foolish past love and profound loneliness. Side B features five collaborations with, among others, the rappers Black Bear and the late Juice WRLD, and the previously released hit Close to Me with Diplo. Collaborations have always been scary to me, says Goulding, but this was a way of doing them where I felt I was a superhero character. Trick Mirrors. These four books spin fictional identities for real people, real identities for fictional people, and slide all kinds of doors in between. Rodham, published by Random House. In this imagined personal history, Curtis Sittenfield, American wife, prep, creates a universe in which Hillary never became a Clinton. Hollywood Park, published by Celadon. Michael Jollette's debut memoir explores his childhood in the Synanon cult and his path to becoming frontman for the Airborne Toxic Event. Broken People, published by Hanover Square Press. In the wake of his 2016 memoir, The Gilded Razor, Sam Lansky plumbs his life again, Hollywood, addiction, for his debut novel. The Vanishing Half, published by Riverhead. A pair of twins separate as teens and go on to live divergent lives in Britt Bennett's follow-up to her best-selling debut, The Mothers. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast. www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.